Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Golden, and welcome to Making Markets. This show explores the psychology and structure that make up markets all over the world. Each week, we speak to experts about a different market so you can see what actually happens when money changes hands. From mainstream stock and bond markets to esoteric niches like vineyards, antique art, and crypto, we explain the transactions that underpin our economy. Making Markets is part of the Colossus family of podcasts, and you can find all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources at joincolossus.com.
Eric Golden is the CEO of Canopy Capital. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the views of Canopy Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes and should not be construed or relied on as investment, legal, or tax advice. Clients of Canopy Capital may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast, including positions that are contrary to the opinions offered.
My guest this week is Brutus Clay. Brutus is the chairman and CEO of Runnymede Farms, the oldest operating thoroughbred farm in Kentucky. He takes us through the fascinating world of breeding and racing thoroughbreds. We start by going over the process and economics of breeding racehorses. We then talk about the buyers in the market and how they ascribe value and earn return on their investments. We end by talking about the horse racing industry's future and the beautiful story of a horse called Cody's Wish. Please enjoy this unique conversation with Brutus Clay. Brutus, thank you for joining me today. I'm excited to talk about the industry of horse racing, breeding, trading, what it means to own a horse. It's a fascinating space. I was introduced by a college roommate, but I thought a great place to start would to ask you, how did you get into horse racing?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's an involved story. But in short, the way I got involved really is divine intervention and nepotism. My family has been in the horse business. Actually, we're the oldest continuous thoroughbred farm in Kentucky. Got started in 1867 with my great-grandfather, Colonel Ezekiel Clay. And they bred a lot of really good racehorses over the life of the farm. We've been birthplace to four Kentucky Derby winners. The first one was Ben Brush in 1896, and the last one was Mage, 2023 winner on behalf of our clients, Grandview Equine. But I'm one of eight children, a large Catholic family. I liked money too much, so I really didn't want to go into the horse business. And went off to business school and have been in real estate and in restaurants and a number of different endeavors. But right around 2000, I was talking to my mother and she's like, your brother Catesby is thinking he might do something else. And all along, he's been always very passionate about horses and horse racing. He's not so interested in money. So I was like, mother, don't be ridiculous. What else might he do? Well, now I refer to my brother as Father Chris or Father Catesby. He became a Catholic priest. And right around 2009, my father was thinking that we needed to have the farm actually pay for itself. And my background in business, it really seemed to have appeal and be something that the farm needed. So they are like, Brutus, you need to figure this out. And since 2009, I've been involved in it, brought in a new manager who's now our president, Roman Millet, and we've had a fair amount of success.
It's such a fascinating space, but I think it can be confusing with terms and some of the verbiage. So help me understand, what are the segments of horse racing? We've got the breeding of horses, we have owning, trading of horses, we have the racing industry. How would you segment the market?
First thing, when people think of owning horses, they think of owning a racehorse. And the thing is racehorses, they just don't all of a sudden just happen. There's a lot that goes into it. And there's a whole industry about breeding thoroughbreds. And it's international, Europe, Asia, Japan, Australia. It's a global industry, but there are different types of farms. And Kentucky, we're really the horse capital of the world, or that's what we claim. We're certainly one of the best places in the United States or in the world to raise horses. But as far as the industry is concerned, in Kentucky, for example, there's about 400 farms or that are nurseries that they don't own stallions, but they own mares. And by the way, Mares is a female horse that's 4 years older. Then a Stallion is a male horse that can stand and breed. So the Stallion farms, there's about a dozen Stallion farms. Those are generally, probably the majority of those farms are owned by billionaires, just because you're looking at some really large numbers that we'll talk about later. And the nurseries can be a good bit more modest means of people involved in that. And that's where Runnymede falls in. We are a nursery. We have an acre for every single day of the year, 365 acres. And right now we have 56 mares on the farm. We own an interest in 33 of them and have clients and partners in those horses. And we breed them and we charge a rate like a hotel for the caring of the horse and then selling them.
So you mentioned that Kentucky is the best place on earth. And I think that for casual American sports fans, we know about the Kentucky Derby, maybe about Saratoga or Belmont. It can be limited knowledge. What is it about Kentucky that makes it the horse capital of the world?
So I'm going to let everyone on this podcast in on the real answer, because there's the Chamber of Commerce answer here in Kentucky. And they all just say it's because of the limestone under the topsoil. Calcium leaches into the water and the soils and builds strong bones for the horses and this ideal climate and rolling hills and so on. So the land. And I was thinking about that and I was like, yeah, that doesn't really make all that much sense. So I went back and I started looking from 1830, from the earliest stages of where they were tracking leading sires in the United States. And when I looked at it, from 1830 to 1849, only six of those leading sires were in the state of Kentucky, and 11 were in Tennessee and other states. So it was a small percentage. And what happened was the Civil War. And then secondly, there was this sire called Lexington, who was leading sire for 16 years. Not only was he a tremendous sire, but he replicated, and his sons were really very dominant breeders and replicating the speed that they exhibited themselves. For thoroughbreds, for the first answer is land. So that's 33%. The second is the bloodstock. And if you have to have a live cover, you have to have the mare and stallion in close proximity. And if you had a good mare, you want to be where the good stallions are. And if you had a good stallion, you want to be where the good mares are. So it's kind of like that first mover, that disruption of the Civil War in Lexington. And then the third reason, it's at least equally important, which people don't talk about, but I think is really quite inspiring. It's the people. And it's not the people that were born into it. Actually, if you look at our farm, I'm the only one that grew up in it. It's people that love horses and that are passionate about horses. And do you know what they dream about when they are little? Coming to Kentucky, because it's the greatest place in the world to raise horses. So when you have those three components, you have a really pretty deep moat that makes it very difficult for other regions to compete. And certainly the veterinary clinics, the farriers, the horse people involved, it's just really hard for those other regions to compete when you have that critical mass. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out where to start in the life of a horse. Let's just start at the beginning. Walk me through the economics, the numbers of how a potential racehorse comes to being.
So I'll just use Runnymede's like operations and how we approach it as an example of how it works. So we sell our horses primarily in the fall, or with Saratoga with Fasig Tipton or Keeneland in September. And can you imagine going three quarters of the way through your year and you don't know if you're going to lose money, break even, make money until these horses go through the sale? And you might have some slight idea, but you just don't know until they go through the ring and the hammer drops. We figure out how much money we've made or lost, and we have. And then we'll be like, okay, let's go buy some mares. And the sales for the mares or the breeding stock sale at Keeneland and at Fasig Tipton, that's in early November. And we will go out and we will look at the mares, and you'll look at the family lines. We'll look at how she ran on the track. It'd be ideal that they were fast and they came from a deep family. And through their involvement. And generally, we'll spend anywhere, on average, it's about $300,000 for a mare. Then we will either breed them or we will have that foal. They're already in foal.
Does that mean it's pregnant?
It's pregnant. If they're in foal, they're pregnant. And foal is a baby. As Malcolm Gladwell with Outliers outlined with the NHL, you want to have your all thoroughbreds in the Northern Hemisphere. Their birthdays are January 1. So you want to have their birthday in the earlier part of the year. And the gestation period is about 11 months. So we start breeding on Valentine's Day. It's not very romantic, but trust me, people with black jackets, helmets, safety is paramount, but we start breeding the mares. And what we'll do is we'll pay for the privilege for our mares to be covered or bred by a stallion. And that stud fee doesn't come due until the foal stands and nurses. So you have a pretty good idea that they're going to be okay. And on average, we'll spend about $60,000 on a stud fee. To give you an idea of rough economics, as a general rule, you want to sell the yearlings for 3 times your stud fee. So to hit break even on that horse, you have to sell them for us would be $180,000.
And so a yearling is a one-year-old horse that can run around.
One-year horse. Yeah, they've turned around. And then you don't sell them until August or September of that following year.
And this process, so you own the female horses to do the breeding. Those cost like $300,000. The famous stallions that are the billionaires, the other part of the equation, if they're getting paid $60,000, how many horses can they make per year? How many stud fees can they collect per year?
The most they'll produce will be just under a year in the Northern Hemisphere. And sometimes they ship them down to the Southern Hemisphere to breed down there as well. But they could cover close to 240, 250. I think Gunrunner was one of the top sires, who's $250,000 now, covers about 240 mares. The foals from that will be roughly somewhere between 70 and 80% of that's just under 200. But for easy math, so 200 foals round up, and you're looking at 250. You're looking at $50 million in revenue associated with what?
Every year.
Every year that that stallion is producing good horses and the market wants to go to them.
It's just crazy. I think this will make more sense when you see how much people spend on horses. So for Gunrunner, is it something like it's a stallion, it won, everyone likes it, and it's a couple of years? Is it a decade? How long can Gunrunner be a desired stallion?
Well, I think Galileo, who was owned by Poolmore in Ireland, I believe he produced close to $1 billion worth of value.
Holy shit. Wow.
I'm going to say it was 2001 or 2002, his first year, freshman sire, Runnymede bred to him. And it was our record sale up until last year. And we sold Colt for $1.8 million. He's just had a profound impact on the breed of thoroughbreds, particularly in Europe.
And so I'm curious about how like the revenue gets split with all of this, where so I have a stallion and I'm getting paid $250,000. That sounds awesome every time for 200 times a year. So I make $50 million off of that. Who's taking the risk on the auction value of that colt? That $1.8 million, is that all risk at the farm, or do you guys split it? We'll do 50-50, whatever this horse is worth.
Typically, if they have a stallion that's a little bit less marketable or in demand, and you have a good mare, they will do a foal share where you put up the mare, you cover all those costs, and you'll take split it 50-50. We generally don't do that as a farm just because if we have a mare that isn't worth the investment in the stud fee, then we shouldn't have the mare.
Okay.
From our perspective.
So you're breeding all these horses. And so once a year, you have something like 50 new foals that are born.
We're expecting around 30, 4 foals this year on the farm. Yeah.
And back to your example, having no idea what these 34 are worth, how do you end up at the auctions to value those horses? How does that process work?
That's the thing I think is incredible, is imagine Bill Belichick and all he had to go on. He'd be like, hey, Eric, did your dad play football? How about your brothers? Did they play Division I? And there wouldn't be no NFL combine. There would be no college football. There would be no high school football, no data points like that. He would just have what your siblings and what your ancestors did. And then he would look at you. And imagine you wouldn't be like a polished, finished super athlete just then. We might try to pretty you up a little bit, though, to get you in pretty good shape. But then he'd have you stand there and he'd look at you and make sure that you had the right build. And maybe a better analogy would be a track coach at college or something like that. He'd have you walk. Wouldn't have you run. He'd have you walk. And the thing that I think is astounding, for instance, the early part of the sales at Keeneland, the best bred horses, looking horses, they select and they put in the early days. In the first couple of days, the averages will be close to $400,000. And so you have all these horses that are all relatively similar type breeding. They're all very fashionable sires, $200,000 stud fee plus. And then you'll have one go instead of $500,000, will go for $2 million. And it's because that horse had that it factor, or the horse checked all the boxes, but it's more than checking the boxes. It had that something about that horse. And imagine you watch a golfer like Tiger Woods, their swing, where it's just efficiency in motion, the way they move. And a horse that moves well can add multiples for what they sell. It's not just looking at your eyes, but it's listening. I remember we just hired Roman. We go to look at some weanlings, which are horses that are foals. They're not quite a year old, but they have been weaned. They're no longer with their mothers. And they can be sold in November. So we are looking at them, and it's a whole nother thing, pinhooking, where you buy horse for a relatively short period, you buy them as a weanling and you sell them as a yearling. And we're looking to do that. And we had this filly walk by. Filly would walk by and he'd look at me. He's like, did you hear that? And I'd be like, no. And he did it again. I was a bit indignant. I was like, no, what are you talking about? And he looks at me and says, exactly. She's light on her feet. She just moves. So when you look at it that way, you have those senses. Or another bloodstock agent who buys horses from us on a regular basis and bought Corniche, these really incredibly talented horses. I'd watch her and she'd go up to the horse and she would get about 6 inches away from their head. And she would stand there. And I was like, why do you do that? She's like, well, I want to see how the horse responds if they back up, or if they're aggressive, or if they just stand there like, yeah, you're there, and I'm here. And the one I just described, that's how you want to see a horse respond. But you read their personalities, because it's not just the physical ability. You're trying to figure out if they have that desire, that drive to be a champion.
How much at this phase of the buying process do you think is provable, repeatable in the investment process versus a bunch of people just guessing, in the sense that I would have thought that in your example of the Bill Belichick calling Nick Saban in college and being like, look, you bred these guys. You've known them since they were born. I would have assumed you've got inside information that Runnymede knows, yeah, this one's it. Or is it just at this phase, it's just still unknown yet over what these horses are going to become? So this is really speculation versus no, there's people that they do a regular job of having a better ROI at the auctions.
So you're asking, did we know that Mage was going to win the Kentucky Derby when he was a foal? And the answer is no.
Yeah, was Mage different when he was born?
No. I mean, he was nice. He was a sensible horse. He wasn't stupid. He went about and did things well, but would he stand out? And I certainly wouldn't pick him out. And more importantly, Roman or anyone on our team would be like, that's our one. No, not necessarily. And Dornick, his full brother that's on the Derby trail, he looks like a beautiful, big horse, powerful horse. But would you say that horse is going to win the Kentucky Derby? These bloodstock agents, even when they're really good at what they do, and the ones that are, some buy a few horses, so those numbers, their percentages are much higher, real volume, they're right about, to give you an idea, there's 429 graded stakes races a year. And there's 36,000 races a year. So you're looking at about 1.2 of all races are graded stakes races. And they can increase the probability to being low teens if they're really good. So 10x. But a lot of these have unlimited budgets. And they'll pay $1 million for a horse. And you have to figure that many of them can run. But when I say they're right, we're really talking about a graded stakes winner. And really, when they're spending that type of money, they're hoping if they buy 10 horses, that they get one that is going to be a grade one winner, which, to put it in perspective, in 2024, I think that's now less than 100. It's like 93 races that are going to be grade one races in 2024.
So, I mean, I think I always associated, and you've talked about it, and the background, your family and your brother, that horses and money don't go well together. That's a great way to lose money. And I know guys on Wall Street who have gotten to horse racing, and it might be a passionate thing. It's definitely not a return business. What are the economics that people are looking at when they're spending $1 million on a horse if it's so hard to win one of these important races?
Many of the stallion operations, they make their money on the breeding. And they have a portfolio approach of how they get those future stallions. The thing is you might have a gun runner, but those farms are actively out there looking for the next gun runner. You have to be out there buying more and more, racing by yearlings or breeding your own horses, buying two-year-olds. And then what happens is when horses on their Derby trail and leading up to the Derby, the stallion operations are coming in and saying, I will buy your horse once they retire for X. And as a real broad rule of thumb, let's say if stallion's going to stand for 50,000, they would multiply that by 300, which is what you'd think how many seasons you'd be able to sell until the stallion's offspring are racing, and determine if people are still going to be sending their mares to them. Does that make sense?
I think so. So you're saying it was the 50,000, the fees they're collecting?
So let's say the stud fee would be 50,000, and then they multiply by 300. So you're looking at 15 million valuation. The thing is, really, they have 2 years, 3 years to get their money out before the jury comes back and with the verdict of if that stallion's going to make it or not. And to me, I think that's a really fascinating side of the business, because the industry really, right now, they like to breed to freshman sire. And then the second year the stallion is standing is also a good time to breed to them. The third year, it's a risk, because by the third year, they will have three-year-olds racing by the time you go to sell. And when that happens, the jury comes back, he's like, this is good. You look like a hero, or you look like you have made a mistake. But what's really interesting is being able to read the tea leaves of how the yearlings look, how the foals look, to determine if you want to take that risk. If the yearlings look like the stallion or they're stamped, that's a very bullish signal, because they're replicating themselves. If they look like the sire, it means that his genes are dominant and can improve a mare. And when that happens, you'll look at the yearling cells, and presumably if they're a stallion, they're, a lot of them are pretty good looking. They sell for a fair amount, and you can use that as a buy signal that you should roll the dice a little bit.
One of the reasons why I started the podcast and went in this direction, because I love how many things are analogous, where it reminds me of venture capital or private equity. When people start a new fund company, they'll say fund one is easy to raise because you're betting on the person. And fund two is you're still betting on the person, but there isn't anything to see. But funds die at fund three and four, because now you can look at the results of fund one and fund two and hold them up to something. It's so funny that in horse breeding, it's a very similar analogy.
It really is. You bring up funds like private equity or venture capital. And for thoroughbred racing, I said that I didn't really like horse racing or the farm because I like money too much. And the thing is I graduated in 92 from Georgetown University. And I remember that was when the economy was, they changed the tax laws. So doctors couldn't write off the losses of owning racehorses against their ordinary income in 86. So it all came back to roost by that time. And all these farms were for sale. And I was like, oh, this is a horrible business. Well, anyway, I didn't really understand the value of a racehorse. And the industry probably will be like, Brutus, shut up. Don't say this. But I personally believe in transparency. So for every dollar that you train a horse, which let's say 50,000 is a pretty good round average number, it's right around 30,000 that they win back on average. So you get 60 cents back. So Eric, if I came to you and I was like, I have a bet for you. You bet a dollar and on average, you're going to get 60 cents back. Is that a very good bet?
No.
No. Didn't take you too long to figure that one out. So I was looking at it and I was like, what's the hurdle rate for a fund for VC net of fees? 25% or something like that?
Yeah.
All right. So I said, it's like VCs because it's like one or two out of the 10 carry all of them, right?
Yep.
Sounds very similar. Okay. Now, if I said to you, Eric, I have a deal for you. We'll buy 10 racehorses and then we're going to travel the country and watch our horses race. And one or two of them are going to win grade one races and we're going to collect the trophies. We're going to go out and have a big time doing it. And you're going to get a 25% return on your investment. On average, you would look at me and say, Brutus, that sounds too good to be true. That just sounds like too much fun. And I don't believe you. And you'd be absolutely right, because the difference of the efficient frontier of what just a financial return would require and what the actual return is, the components are two different things. It's the value of the experience and the lottery ticket effect. And as I like to say, even millionaires and billionaires like to dream. The whole idea of really hitting the lottery, of having a stallion or a mare that sells for $6 million, like Goodnight Olive, won the Breeders' Cup. You have these horses that sell for $6 million afterwards, and your cost might be $300,000, $400,000. That's kind of exciting. And it didn't just happen on the racetrack. And what happens, here's the reason that our industry is so difficult, is that people that own racehorses are like, gosh, this is a lot of fun, but maybe I should buy a farm, because if I buy a mare, there's a chance that I could actually make a return on my investment. And in most industries where people lose money consistently or businesses lose money, what do? They go bankrupt and they get out. And the supply and demand recalibrates and you have an efficient market. What happens with thoroughbreds is we have people that have other businesses that they're willing to subsidize their thoroughbred farms with in order to keep doing it, because it's such an incredibly enriching experience to be a part of. And so, as I say, I said we have to sell our horses for 3x stud fee. Reality is it needs to be higher than that for us because we own the farm. But if you look at the average for most of the stars that we breed to, they will range between 2.1 to 2.7 times stud fee. So if we're average, we're out of business. And the question is, how do you do? To give you an idea, for the last 10 years since Roman has been part of the team, we've averaged 3.9 times stud fee. sometimes horses don't sell, and that's our stud fees and what we generate from the sales, which is a pretty extraordinary figure. And the way you do that is you raise fast horses.
Where it is such a market where the ROI is not pure dollars and cents, people are obviously buying for experience. Is there a Warren Buffett or a Jim Simons of the industry? Are there people that are on two sides? One, that are just amazing at buying horses at low prices, but they just have a thing of raising them and making great profits? Or I'm also curious if the quantitative side, it does seem like every industry where there's money, Moneyball-like effects get in, where people are taking diversified bets and using a lot of computers and data to try to find an edge?
That's a great question. And the answer is yes, to varying degrees. And there's people that make a living off of horses and they'll breed some, but where they make a good bit of their money is by trading. And they understand the value of a horse. They can look at a horse and say, oh, Eric is a diamond in a rough. He's ready to go. Might not look it, but I can bring him part of my stable. I could buy him as a yearling, prep him and break him and get him ready for the two-year-old sale and resell him for a profit, or weanling to a yearling, or buy a mare that just is racing on the track and claim them for a fixed price and then put them in full and then sell them. So there's people that are trading. Runnymede, that's not really our business because we're more breeders. I think that can be a little bit of a distraction, and we just want to produce good race horses. So we like to have a little bit more of a long-term relationship with the horses that we're involved with.
What are the odds of getting to the Kentucky Derby? I don't even want to be naive and assume that's not the highest honor in horse racing, if there's something else.
Oh, it is.
So is it fair to assume that when I see the 20 horses, however many horses they have in that Derby that year, that every horse in that lineup was a great investment for whoever made it? Or is it possible that you're in the Derby, but you still lost money unless this horse does decent?
Put it in perspective, in 2021, there'd be about 19,000 foals in North America. And so you're looking at 9,250 that would be colts on average. And then there's 20 that make it into the gates. So those are odds are really stacked against you. And then there's one winner. Now, the thing is, if you have a horse going into the Derby, you're best to sell that horse before they make it into the gate, because everyone wants the Kentucky Derby runner. So they'll pay a lot of money for that privilege.
So are a lot of horses sold right before the Derby? Like, when you see those people, they're like, this is our horse. They could have bought it like a week ago.
Doesn't happen all that often. People, when they get a horse that can get them to the Kentucky Derby, they're not interested in letting go. That dream has been around for a while.
Yeah.
They're finally getting there. There's that walk from the backside and to be able to make that walk. And anything can happen when Ridge Strike, which was what, 90-1 or something like that, end up winning. So the odds are stacked. And the most incredible thing happened last weekend. One of the owners of Dornick that we fold and raise on behalf of Grandview, the full brother to Mage, has enough points to qualify for the Kentucky Derby. And he won the Fountain of Youth. So he provided he's healthy, he's going. And they had a horse who's also by Good Mavis. Both of them, their father, Good Mavis, the sire. And the same agent, Connor Foley, picked these, and he bought 10 horses that year. And they had another horse that was in the Wood Memorial. It was 106-1. I think it was his second race. And he came in second, and he qualified for the Kentucky Derby.
Oh, my God.
I mean, could you imagine being a part of that? It's like, oh, just so much fun. So they have two horses that are pointing towards the Kentucky Derby, which is an extraordinary accomplishment. It really is. And they have a shot. actually all the horses have a shot. And I think that's the thing that's kind of exciting is you have these owners that have just pretty much infinite resources. But if you have the fastest horse, it levels the playing field, doesn't it? And it doesn't matter what they pay for it.
We talked about it in the past, but I think maybe it's the wrong analogy that I was thinking about. If a horse is like Formula One, even though the drivers get attention, the jockeys are there and the trainers get their picture taken and the farms, and there's all these people that come to do about it, that it's the car that's usually winning Formula One. And there are teams that have unlimited funds that subsidize their races and put so much money into it to win. But there's just a level of randomness in horse racing that I don't think is like anything else.
There's some randomness, but there's all sorts of rules or things, and then there's always exceptions to it. So as soon as you think you have it figured out, there will be an example that says, no, you're not right all the time. They only, top trainers might be winning 25, 27% of the time. One of the things that I think is really that desire, that drive, all that will, that plays a role in it. A horse can be physically capable of moving and have all the biomechanics to do it. But if they don't have that drive, they're not going to be the horse that ends up winning, which we'll touch upon with Cody's Wish. Another thing that I think is inspiring is how many people were involved in getting Mage to the Derby. How many hands touched him? The farriers, the veterinarians, the grooms. You go through the list of all the different people, the bloodstock agents. And I was thinking, in a way, in all those people, when that horse wins the Kentucky Derby, it's like, we all did it. The people and working together to get there, I think, is as inspiring as the horse themselves. By the way, I think horses really have the capacity to inspire people and heal. I think that's a really interesting component of it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to frame it. And maybe now it's a perfect time to talk about Cody's Wish. And I promise I won't get all teared up this time. But why don't you explain the story around Cody's Wish and how horse racing impacted a greater population of people?
So back in 2018, there's a Make-A-Wish Foundation at Keeneland. And Cody Dorman had rare Wolff-Fishbone syndrome, genetic syndrome. It was a pretty severe case where they really didn't believe that, think that he was going to live more than 2 years. And at that time, he would have been 13 or 14, and he did the program Make-A-Wish, and he said he wanted to meet a racehorse. And so he went to Gainsborough Farm to meet a racehorse. The farm pulled out a foal to meet him. And they just randomly did that, trying to find a foal that would be relatively calm and gentle. Well, when the foal saw Cody, the foal went up to him and got real close. And Cody was really inspired and touched by it. So it was a wonderful day. And there was a really strong connection that was made. When Darley was coming up with a name for the horse, this was an exceptional rule. I don't know if they've ever done this before, but they named the horse after Cody, and they called the horse Cody's Wish. COVID was happening, and Cody Dorman, he was really struggling because his regular routine, he couldn't go to school. He was really suffering from depression, and he was watching Cody's Wish run these races. And his first three races, he lost. And Cody Dorman got in his mind, he's like, you know what? This horse needs to see me in order to win. Cody Dorman lives in Kentucky. So they go to Churchill Downs, which is in Louisville. And on his fourth race, Cody's Wish wins the race. Then goes on to win several more races that year. The following year, he goes on and races in the one percenter type races, the graded stakes races, and all comes to a crescendo at the end of the year with Cody's Wish running in the Breeders' Cup Mile at Keeneland, which is also in Kentucky. So I'm at the Breeders' Cup and read a little bit about it. And the way Cody's Wish runs is he's in the back of the pack and then comes around the turn and he will make a run at the end. Cody and his family, are there, his parents are there, his sister's there, and they're in the winner's circle watching the race with the Darley connections. As the race goes on, and you have to watch it because horse comes around the turn and starts making his drive. Then he goes down the stretch and he's trying to get past Cyberknife and they battle. You can see Cyberknife, who's a tremendous horse, fighting back and still trying to keep up. It's not clear that Cody's Wish is going to get by, but he keeps driving and he goes by and he wins. The announcers, there's four announcers covering it, or there might have been three, but only one could speak. And he's like, I'm sorry, we're all speechless. We're all choked up watching this, how inspiring it is. In the winner's circle, everyone's tears, and it's just the most magical thing that you see. I'll make a joke to lighten it up a little bit. Winston Churchill once said, there's something about the outside of the horse that's good for the inside of a man. I also say that it works for women too. But the thing that I think is so powerful about that, it was a movie of that scene. So the following year, horse continues to campaign. They decide to race the horse another year, even though he's worked quite a bit and you could have made a case that he should just retire. So in 2023, he races five times. He comes in third in a race up at Saratoga. And Cody wasn't there, but the race is at Santa Anita. And it's the same race, the mile. And Cody's Wish is in that. Cody this time travels to California to watch the race with the family. And watching the race again, same scenario. Last, then he's second to last, then he makes his run. And he starts battling, passes all the horses except one, National Treasure. And it is nose to nose going back down the straight, back and forth, back and forth. And sure enough, Cody's Wish, and it was by the slimmest of margins. When the announcers asked Cody Dorman, he's like, why is there such a special connection between you and Cody's Wish? This is what he said. He said, he found me. He hasn't forgotten me. We have the same heart, and we will never give up. So that was Cody's Wish's last race, by the way. So he's going to retire to stud. And that was the last race. And the following day, Cody Dorman passed away. Cody's Wish won the Eclipse Award for champion horse, best horse in the United States. Kelly Dorman, his father, accepted the award on behalf of Darley. And he gave just such a moving tribute to Cody and Cody's Wish. That night, it was incredibly powerful. And so I look at this and I think of all these things that are the horse industry, how people are about the safety, and we're certainly working on that and doing better at that, the aftercare and sports gambling and all these things that I think are important and need to be addressed. But then I ask myself, would the world be better off if we didn't have Cody's Wish? And the answer is a resounding no, it would not. And it's funny because you're talking about trading and returns and handicapping and handle, and I can talk about all those things. But in some respects, I think it's a crutch that has been a limitation for our industry. We were so focused on the handle and the gambling. Horse racing didn't want to have the races televised because they wanted people to come to the races and bet. And that's how they made the money. And we were so focused on the handle that we didn't ever occur to us that maybe we should provide a good experience. People pay a fair amount to go to an NFL game or a baseball game or a basketball game. It's not all that compelling when you go to the races and you get a warm beer and a cold hot dog. So you celebrate and you provide an experience, and these horses are inspiring, and the people involved in it and their love and passion for the sport is real. So when you share that, that's compelling. And one of the things that strikes me in another analogy is I'd imagine a lot of people that have gone on the Bourbon Trail and think bourbon is pretty cool. And if you talk to Bill Samuels, who really made Maker's Mark the iconic brand that it is, he would attribute a fair amount of it to the Bourbon Trail and people coming and having those experiences and feeling connected to their brands. One of the things that I helped get started was called Horse Country. It's really the thoroughbred equivalent, thoroughbred trail, where we open our gates, we bring people in to visit our farms and get close to these horses and meet the people behind it and see how they get there. And the thing is, there's no question that it works. It inspires people. There's a marketing score for net promoter scores. And those ratios, a good score would be a 70. Lexus might be close to a 70 or so. Apple would be a 61. Well, thoroughbred racing, before they visit one of these farms, the view of thoroughbred racing of would you recommend people to be a fan of the sport would be a 37. That's pretty darn low. After they visit a farm of horse country, they're 70. That's pretty good. And the net promoter score of the farms that they visit is 92. So I think there's all these challenges in our industry that we have to address. And we're doing those things and we need to do more. But where there's a tremendous opportunity is for us to find our voice of what we are about. And the horse is what we're about. And they have the capacity to inspire, heal, and help in so many different ways. So that's an area that I'm really pretty passionate about, obviously.
The story about Cody is amazing. I think the way you illuminated the industry, the reason I talked to you about it is you don't sugarcoat it. It's an industry, like you said, that the net promoter score would be low, but as more people understand it, learn it, the ability to inspire and give people something to be passionate about is truly wonderful. The way we end these podcasts, we'll go back to markets briefly, is just your outlook on where we are in the industry cycles of, is it that the industry is fearful because it's got to get through some contraction, or is it optimistic because gambling is being more widely adopted in entertainment and everyone's moving from consumers to experiences? Where are we?
Fearful for the reasons that you outlined. There's increased competition with sports gambling, with sports wagering. There's the welfare of horses, which is a concern that we're working to address. There's just increased competition for people's time in their wallets. There's optimism, because when things aren't working, it causes you to change and rethink about your model, what is important. And I see the industry taking steps to the racetracks, thinking about the experiences they're providing, the farms. Runnymede, we were a closed farm, private farm, as my father would say. We didn't allow people to come in and see it. But now farms are opening their gates and connecting people to what we're about. And I think that those things, with celebrating the horse and the people and the land, and Kentucky is an absolutely beautiful setting, particularly this time of year. When you share that, it's contagious. And the thing is, it's another thing that we would say is, one of the challenges of the industry is the horses reach national prominence with the Triple Crown, and then they retire. So there's no continuity. And at the time when I was thinking about, we're starting a horse country, is like, well, what's the difference between that and University of Kentucky basketball? One and done school. We'd recruit them, they play for a year, and they go. The difference is people are fans of the team first and the player second. And furthermore, when we refer to our teams, our college team or our professional team, we say, that's my team. But do you actually own that team? No, doesn't matter. So the question I ask is, why can't we make people fans of farms? Because they can be following the horses that come off these farms, and they can come and visit. And each year, there's another crop. And there's always a different story. There's always an update. I think there's a lot of opportunity. It's going to be much more focused on the experiential side of it versus just focusing on wagering. And the wagering, don't get me wrong, it's a ton of fun trying to pick up on those patterns and handicap these races. And there's such a tremendous amount of data. And for people that like that, which I am one of those people, it's hugely entertaining. But I think that we have a much more broader appeal and could appeal to people's spouses about the horses and the experience and the environment of the racetrack and everything else.
Well, Brutus, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you, Eric. Really enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed this episode, check out joincolossus.com. There you will find every episode of this podcast, along with transcripts, our weekly newsletter, and resources to continue your learning.